This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Remember going off to college and the friendships that you built? Some of them have lasted a lifetime, I'm sure. Well, today we have a special meet that features that kind of friendship. Four women, each with a dream to become a lawyer and each following a path that led them to becoming judges. Their friendship began at McLean Dorm at North Carolina Central University School of Law in 1998. Back then, they referred to themselves as the Golden Girls. The name stuck after they played an online game together.
Once they all played the game with me and it came back revealing that this would be Blanche, this would be Dorothy, this would be Sophia, and this would be Rose, they bought in and the rest is history.
And that history is something that we will go over today. That was Camille Banks-Prince on ABC 11 in Durham. Today we welcome Judge Banks-Prince along with her three law school classmates. Welcome to the show, Golden Girls. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Good to be here. Pleasure.
Let me ask you to introduce yourselves. Shamika, I'll start with you.
All right. I am Shamika Ryan. I have the pleasure of serving Durham County as a district court judge.
And my name is Camille Banks-Prince, and I serve as a district court judge in Forsyth County.
My name is Keisha Wright-Hill, and I sit as a juvenile court judge, Judge Pro Temp in Clayton County, Georgia.
And I am Teresa Raquel Robinson-Freeman, and I enjoy serving the citizens of my home county, Halifax, as well as neighboring counties of Northampton, Bertie, and Hertford.
So you've got quite a representation geographically of the state of North Carolina as well. Camille, you and Shamika were on campus first. Tell us about the program and meeting together when you met at NC Central.
Yes, well, North Carolina Central University has a unique program for students who have most of the characteristics and qualities that they're looking for law students, but they may be lacking in some area, namely the LSAT. And so it's called performance-based admission. And Shamika and I were in that program in the in August, or was it July of 1998. So she and I actually became friends very quickly during that two-week time frame.
Shamika, do you remember meeting Camille?
When you meet Judge Banks-Prince, you can never forget her. She makes a impression on you that is impressed upon your mind forever. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I do remember.
Well, how so? What do you mean?
Well, essentially, I will say I was with my best friend, Nakia, and so we were in the bathroom, and Camille is in the bathroom saying, well, she's put on mascara. You know, this helps because I don't have any eye features. And so we're looking like, who is this person? And so that was my first impression and meeting of Camille.
All right. Well, Teresa, talk about how you came in later with Keisha, but tell us about becoming friends and how you sort of bonded in that first year.
Sure. So if you've ever had a conversation with Keisha, she has a very magnetic personality, and I don't know of anyone who she's ever come into contact with who didn't like her, and if you did, then it's your problem, not hers. So we were in the same section when we were in law school. I don't know if they still do it the same way now, but they split us into two sections. And so Keisha and I happened to be in the same law school section, and I was just drawn to her personality. We became fast friends. I don't know if she remembers a individual specific story, but I just remember her personality to still the same way today. Then when we found out that all four of us were living in the same dorm. In fact, we were the only law students living on campus.
On
that was
same
a very
yeah.
absolute uh-huh. very same floor same and across floor. From each other. Mm-hmm. So we were we had to become fast friends then because we were very unique in that way, in that we didn't have our own apartment or the luxuries that other law students had. We were on campus.
Well, talk about that experience for you, Keisha, because you actually were coming from Georgia. These three ladies who had been here, they lived in North Carolina.
Correct. And it was my first time really getting away from home. I'm from Atlanta, and I attended Spelman College, which was 15, 20 minutes from my home. So actually, this is my first time going out of state. So I knew no one. And they were the first people that I met. And we went from becoming strangers to classmates to roommates to best friends.
Well, tell us a little bit more about about your trajectory in becoming a lawyer. Camille, you said you've known for a long time that you were going to be a lawyer. It was a divine imperative, in fact, right?
Yes, it was a childhood dream. Yeah. I was 10 years old, and interestingly enough, that's the same year that the show Golden Girls, it was about that time, the mid-80s, when that show came out. But I'd known since 10 years old I wanted to be an attorney, and once that decision was made by me, I've stuck with that.
What was it that inspired you?
As I said to other people in the past, something as trivial as a court TV show, it was Divorce Court, yeah, is what I saw. Yeah. And I saw lawyers on there, and I saw them advocating. And I knew inherently by being the oldest child, I was that person who advocated for my younger siblings. I defended them. So it was just something that was, I felt like I possessed innately.
Did you win many cases at home?
I won all cases. And I still do.
We need some witnesses for that.
Yeah,
witnesses for that.
Shamika, how about you? What made you become a lawyer?
Well, you know, I grew up in Rocky Mountain, North Carolina. I didn't grow up with much. My grandmother was the matriarch, and her oldest son, I was between two professions. I wanted to be either teacher, but when I saw my uncle, the way he was able to help people in the community, he was an attorney. Mm-hmm. I said, well, maybe, you know, people say I got the gift of gab. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I can help people as well. And so after I went to UNC, I graduated, go Heels. I then, in 1998, I entered into the North Carolina Central School of Law. And so I have a big heart already. And mm-hmm. so the fact that attorneys can help people is where I went to law school.
Teresa, you wanted to help people, but not as a lawyer originally, right?
Yeah. I never had that as a childhood dream. In fact, I wanted to be a teacher. That's still my first love, teaching. Mm-hmm. My mother, God bless her soul, who's gone on now, was a teacher for 40 plus years in my hometown, home county of Halifax County, and my sister was an English major as well. And so I became an English education major behind them, and that is my first love. I wanted to teach. But interestingly enough, when I got ready to graduate from North Carolina A&T State University, Aggie Pride, mm-hmm. I just was not ready to go out into the work world. It sounds basic, but that's exactly what happened. I happened to run across a random lawyer, I wish I could remember his name, who was on campus, who just said to me in passing, you should consider law school. You're an English major. You speak well. You write well. Apply. And so I did. And that was how my journey toward becoming a lawyer began.
What about you, Teresa? Your journey to law school, what made you want to be a lawyer? That was Teresa who I was speaking to.
I knew in the ninth grade, I was in honors English, and we had an assignment to do. I went to the library. My high school librarian, who I'm still in contact with and Facebook friends with, helped me pick Thurgood Marshall to do a report on. And it was through the research of doing that paper that I learned he was a champion of the poor, that he fought for justice. He was the first African-American United States Supreme Court justice. So I said, well, maybe I can be the first African-American female United States Supreme Court justice. That's where it was birthed for me to be an attorney, and I've never wavered from that.
What about being judges? Was that, I guess I'll just go around the table, and Camille, start with you. Was that in the works, in your planning when you started law school? Did you think about becoming a judge?
No, I did not. But what I did know is that I wanted to return to Forsyth County, which is where I grew up, mm-hmm. and I knew that I wanted to run for office, just didn't know what yet. But after I got back and worked for several years, several people said to me early on, you would make a great judge. And so the seed was planted, mm-hmm. and I just thought about it and pondered it. And the next thing you know, the opportunity for an appointment by Governor Easley came up. And that is how I ended up in this position. That
and
was in.
You've won election to that seat since, that bench since.
Yes, yeah. Since 2008.
Were there politicians in your family? You said you knew you wanted to run for office.
And that's why I say it was divine. There were no lawyers, there were no judges, no one in the justice system, no police officers, nothing. So some people might think things are trivial, like that television show, but God can use anything to inspire
Absolutely.
You.
Well, what about who among you was actually thought of themselves as a judge. Did any of you think, imagine in law school that you were headed?
No,
well, you
I
wanted
did.
To be the first Supreme Court
right.
African. So
we just
so
was trying
go.
To get through law school.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely,
yeah. Across the stage
yeah.
as attorneys.
Yeah. You think of career choices later.
Envision yeah. becoming well, judges.
Well, talk about that because you talked about it being in a program. You, Shamika, and Camille both in a program that was got you an early start mm-hmm. at the law school. This is for people who may not have taken the LSATs, mm-hmm. right? Did school come easy for you up until then?
It
yes.
is. I will be honest. Yeah. I mean, I did well throughout in, you know, college. And when you get to law school, you have to check your ego
yes.
because you have brilliant people who are just as smart
yes.
all around you. And so, you know, that misplaced confidence sometimes doesn't pan out well. And so you're immediately humbled by the law school experience.
We talk about that. Was anybody shocked by the fact that if you're A students, you're maybe just not going to get all A's in law school?
Look, it was a, it was immediate to me that I was going to be a C student, but C meant competent.
Yes, it did.
Absolutely.
Yes, it
did. I graduated as valedictorian of my high school class, and then not quite valedictorian, but I had mostly A's in college as well. But I told you I was an English major as well at A&T. And so I was used to descriptive, flowery writing. And then when I get to law school, the law professor is marking up my papers with this red ink. And I'm like, what are you doing? I can write well. What are you doing?
Yeah.
My English professor told me so. And so I had to really get used to that technical writing. And that was a huge learning curve for me that first semester. And, as she said, getting used to that hard C and knowing that the C stood for competence.
Well, we will find out how these competent women became judges in North Carolina and Georgia. The Golden Girls, Shamika Reinhart, District Court Judge in Durham County. Camille Banks-Prince, District Court Judge in Forsyth. Teresa Raquel Robinson Freeman, District Judge in Northeast North Carolina. And Keisha Wright Hill, a juvenile judge pro temp in Clayton County, Georgia. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with the Golden Girls. They are judges. They started together at North Carolina Central University School of Law, and one by one, each were either elected or appointed judges. And they are four friends with a story of faith, friendship, and family and how that led them to the bench. Shamika Reinhart is a district judge in Durham County. Camille Banks-Prince, district court judge in Forsyth. Teresa Raquel Robinson Freeman, a district judge in Northeast North Carolina. And Keisha Wright Hill, a juvenile court judge in Clayton County, Georgia. So let's talk about getting into law school, because we talked at the end of the last segment about all being good students and the humbling experience that law school can be, going from A's to competent. But Teresa, you had the shocking experience of actually being rejected from NC Central at first. Tell us the story.
I was, with a 3.7 GPA coming out of A&T. So talk about humbling. That was a very humbling experience for me. In fact, I told you I had not planned to become a lawyer initially, and it was kind of a last-minute thought. And so after I received that advice from the attorney, I applied, and I received a letter saying, I'm sorry to inform. We regret to inform. And my mother at the time said, well, just go by to law school. It may have been a mistake, or at least see what you need to do to apply the following year. And I was like, surely it's not a mistake. Entities of this size do not make these types of mistakes, Mom. But moral of the story, always listen to your mother. Because I did, and she went with me to the law school that day, I'll never forget. And I met with the dean at the time, and it was a mistake. My file had been confused with another young lady with the last name of Robinson, which is my maiden name. And so I was admitted on the spot with a full scholarship.
Well, so always listen to your mom, yes.
Yes.
And your mom was with you, so obviously
she
a
was.
Lot of support all the way.
Absolutely.
That's
yes.
good. And Shamika, you talk about the fact that you were not on it from the beginning. There was a little
correct.
Bit of, yeah, tell us the story.
Interestingly, I applied to Central in Carolina. I didn't get into Carolina. And I missed the deadline, thinking that I had made the deadline. And so I automatically went into next year's stack of applicants. Then I didn't get, you know, outright admitted. And so they made an offer for me to go to the PBAT program, which is a program that Camille was referring to. And it's interesting because I almost didn't get invited. I was at Carolina at the time, hadn't forwarded my mail. And my roommate, who was still there, her friend saw it in the discarded mail and said, this looks important. This is from Central. Oh my gosh, Mika, you have an opportunity to go to this program. I said, please send it. And so I do believe in divine, you know, intervention in the fact that had that person not been nosy, yes, nosiness can be used. Right. I would never be sitting here today having this wonderful conversation with these wonderful people.
We'll talk about it the first year, the difficulty of it. And Keisha, it was particularly difficult for you because very early on you lost your father.
Correct. We started August 1998. And my father passed September 27th. Mm. So it was not long after we had started school that he had passed. I attempted to, after the funeral, come back and resume my studies. But I was just too emotionally fragile to continue on. It didn't hit me until I was sitting in my property class and just started crying. I talked to one of my professors. And I was just kind of torn because just being strong, independent, not a quitter, I didn't want to, stop. And basically she said to me, okay, Keisha, you will graduate from law school at age 25 instead of 24. big deal. Go exactly. home, be with your family, take some time for yourself, give yourself an opportunity to grieve, and we'll see you next year.
Yes.
And that's kind of what I needed to get up and go. And then, of course, my golden girls had kept some of my possessions, namely Miss Rose over here kept my TV VCR combo, which was very important to me.
I did.
And so I was like, I'm coming back to get my CD. So I packed my little Ford Escort.
And we helped her pack it up.
It was packed.
Yes. Had the tree sticking out.
It was a non-alcoholic.
Your Honor.
The tree was sticking out the window.
That's right.
And I was just gone. But I just needed that permission to go. I left. I took time with my family. Just reflection. And then after a while, I was kind of coming out of my depression. I was like, okay, it's time to go back to school. And so the good thing was when I came back, of course, I had a new class. These three ladies were 2Ls, and I came back as a 1L, but it wasn't like I was brand new. So I had all of my 1L classes, but I knew all the upperclassmen. I knew all the 2Ls. I was the cool girl.
And you still had your same dorm room.
That's right.
She came
my
back
same
to the same room.
Yeah.
So
same dorm room.
Yeah, so everybody VCR was there. Was still there.
That's right.
I didn't take it.
Everything was there. So I came back to lots of love, lots of encouragement, lots of compassion. So even though I was
lots
away.
Lots of notes and outline.
Absolutely.
Yes. We helped you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you got somebody a year ahead of you now.
Yes.
Got to,
helping me along. So it was, I just stepped right back in. So it was a blessing.
What about family support? Camille, let me ask you about that and the amount of support that you got from your family. And, law school is not cheap. So how did you get through?
Well, scholarships, grants, and some loans is how I got through. Because like Shamika had said, she mentioned earlier, I came from a mainly matriarchal family. And my mom, she did the best she could, but she had three children under me. And my grandmother was my number one supporter, my number one cheerleader, who's still here with me today, 87 years old. And so most of the support that I had from my family was moral support. They were proud of me. But the biggest support I had was these ladies, because your family can't relate. You can talk until the cows come home about how difficult law school is, but until they're entrenched in it, they don't get it. But we were there together, and I can think of a situation I was in right before we graduated, and I was really upset by it, and to the point I couldn't sleep, and I didn't say, ladies, I need you. But they just initiated and came into my room with me that night and slept with me the entire night. Nobody said a word, and just stayed with me. And that bridged the gap to the next morning that I got a phone call that everything was okay. Mm-hmm. But this is the support that I had.
So were there other groups like this, do you think, with other, in law
certainly.
School?
Certainly. I'll say that. Yeah. I know that about Teresa's a part of the Sensational Seven. We were the Holy Trinity. Camille and our other study buddy, Dawn. And so I think the nature of law school, you have to have that educational support from people who, I agree with you, are in the trenches. Staying up late at night, having to go and talk about case law. Your parents and family members, they don't want to talk about you know, cases and, and the law. You know, back then they didn't. And so we had each other to, you know, to study with and to debrief and to laugh. And, I mean, these women were great supports for me. They kept me laughing.
But it wasn't all laughs. We cried.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, we did have some. We had some, you know, we cried. And
well, Shamika, you had to depart with your boyfriend as you move on, and he was heading in a different direction, right?
That was hard. But it was for the best, you know. I think when you're in, you know, a situation like law school, you tend to sometimes go to support systems that might not be the best for you, but they're support system nonetheless when you're able to get out of that situation where you can make better decisions. And so it was hard. They were with me. They knew that my self-esteem and confidence took a hit, but they were there. And they're still there, and he is not. And so,
and on that point, many of us parted with boyfriends.
We all have.
We're all thankful.
We're thankful for those
decisions. Thankful for those parting.
Yeah. Right. Rose up from the ash.
Yeah, we're all still together.
Rose up from the ash.
We're all still together.
You're right. I love it. Yes.
And doing a lot better. But and the work involved, and talk about now even passing the bar. Keisha, you talked about it being, if, as far as you were concerned, a full-time job, right?
Absolutely. I recall studying about 10 hours a day. I would go, and I studied, I had a self-taught, I did MicroMash, Pass Now, Pay Later. I said, that's my type of program. See, I had to do all these multiple-choice questions and essays. So I would go to the library, study from 9 to 12, take a lunch break, study from 2 to 5, take a dinner break, study from 6 to 9, leave the library as they were locking up, and then go do another hour at home, 10 hours a day for like 2 months.
And you got through it.
That's what it takes.
Yes.
Shamika, you didn't make it through the first time.
You know what? I didn't. I missed it, honestly, by a point. I was devastated. And I will say that the Golden Girls, they called and checked on me. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, you feel embarrassed. You feel like, you know, I'm smarter than this. And I didn't. But guess what? The second time, I stuck with it, and I passed. And so.
Well, that's the thing about it. It's just one big test.
You do it all is this one big work, test.
And it almost seems like, how could this possibly be the final?
And I studied hard. I mean, I really studied hard. Yeah. I studied hard. It was a full.
She's a fighter, though. She cried initially, but then she said, I'm going to pass the next time. And she did.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so what do you say at a time like that? You've been through this grueling experience together. You know how smart and capable she is. Mm-hmm. And you know that this test shouldn't be the final arbiter of. What do you say to a friend at a time?
I mean, we've all been through that with plenty of our friends, not just Shamika, and loved ones as well. And you just say exactly as Camille said, cry. It's okay. Cry it out. Get it out. But then you need to get back up and get to studying again because you will pass it. And trust me, no one has ever asked me how many times did it take you to pass the bar. And I want to definitely get that out there because people don't get that.
Well, and if you pass by one point, they don't know that.
No.
That's a two-point differential,
point,
right?
I don't know that. If you pass, they don't tell you. So I have no idea whether I pass by the skin of my teeth or overwhelmingly.
Right.
And I don't care.
Right.
You know.
Let's talk about running for public office now. Teresa, let's start with you because that was an interesting challenge that you had in Eastern North Carolina.
Yes, well, you have to remember that most of us graduated law school at age 25. And so I went to work for a law firm for 4 years, and then I moved back home to become an assistant DA for 3. So I was only 7 years into my legal career when the opportunity presented itself for me to become a judge. And so I'm from a small town, small hometown, and it was a lot of, you're not ready. It's not your time.
Who is telling you this?
At the time, it felt like a big portion of the citizenry.
I know,
negative always seems louder than it really is.
Yes.
Now I know it was only a small portion of people, but if I had to put an age group on it, it was 40 to 60. Citizens age 40 to 60. Now I know it's a small group of people who just thought I wasn't ready. I had not paid my dues, so to speak. I can't count the number of times I heard that. But as I continue to encourage young people when they're telling me about their dreams or something they want to do, just go for it. If you have worked for it and you've prayed for it and you believe it's your time, don't listen to the negative. Tune it out and just go for it. You may not get it. I wasn't guaranteed, but I said at least everyone will know I want to be a judge. So if I don't get it this time, I may be able to get the next appointment or run the next time.
Well, also, there's something insidious about that pay your dues part. I mean, it always sounds like do the work, but what it really means is come through a process that has already been designed and shaped by other people who are already benefiting by this. So if you want to change that system, you really can't be just paying all, we can't have all the dues payers who walk the steps.
Absolutely. Right? You'll be paying dues forever.
Well, and who pays the dues? And who gets strained and filtered through that system and who gets filtered out of that system?
And that system also comes with promises. Mm-hmm. You know, if you back down this time, and I was told that several times, then we'll make sure that we elevate you for the next time. Mm-hmm. Don't stand on those promises.
How did
They're
you
not
do it
guaranteed.
Though? Because those people have a
fair
amount
was
of power.
Hard. Don't let me sound that. Yeah. Don't let it sound easy. It was very hard, but I had the support of my husband. He's awesome. He is truly into positive energy. He is the greatest at tuning out the negative. I'm still learning, but he continually told me, "Tune it out. We've prayed for this. You've worked for this. This is yours. Let's go." So I cried. There were a lot of tears. But every time I cried, he made me stop and do the work.
Yeah. They told me the same thing.
We'll talk about your decision as you make it.
Well, I mean, at the particular time, I had been a DA for almost 12 years. And so, you know, there were some talks with respect to me wanting to pursue this, but everyone didn't know when. And so I had thought about it previously, and I just stated, well, you know, this is a decision, a huge decision. I really don't think that I'm ready. But in 2015, I said I was ready. And it was interesting because when I began having some of the talks with some of the interesting power players within the legal community, they were telling me, oh, you should wait. There's going to be seats in 2018. Why don't you wait your turn? And I said, oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And I said, you know what? If I can live with the decision of at least trying, nothing beats a failure but a try. Mm-hmm. And if I tell everyone to seek their dreams and I don't do the same, I would be considered to me to be a fraud. And so I would rather try and not get it and understood that I was a winner versus a failure than never to have tried at all. And I did it. And now look what happened.
Well, and you were also an assistant district attorney under Mike Nifong. This is a very interesting time to be
in. Yeah, he hired me. His best decision yet. Right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
What did that teach you, that whole episode? We're talking about the Duke lacrosse case now.
What it taught me is that unfortunately, where there are things that might not be up to par, that you still must remain true to your ethics, to the professional code. Although oftentimes you tend to get put in the same basket, which was very disappointing. It was a dark time for me and for the office. But I felt like what it taught me is, one, just continue to work hard, continue to be your character, and your character will stand on its own.
Camille and Forsyth, talk about your decision to move into public office.
Well, the opportunity came up much sooner than I expected. Like Teresa mentioned earlier, I was 6.5 years because I was appointed earlier. She and I were elected the same year, but I started earlier. And so you have the whispers, you're not ready, you're too young, you don't know this person over here has more money, he's politically connected. But my faith is what has carried me through. I didn't have money, I didn't have political ties. But God did bless me with a number of people who saw something in me. Those particular people supported me. And I was working at the time with the Honorable George Russell Clary III, known as Pete, who was the public defender of Forsyth County at the time. He's since retired, but he supported me. I was working for someone who supported me. And then the other judges, some of the lawyers in the community supported me to the governor. But more importantly than any of the other supporters, all of them are important, but North Carolina Central University supported me to a governor who had graduated from North Carolina Central University. So you can't tell me that God does not exist and he doesn't line up appointments and friendships like this.
Yes.
Keisha, talk about your appointment now. You're not an elected position in Clayton County, Georgia, right?
Correct. I started as a magistrate judge. I was appointed there actually in 2012. And then, just as Camille said, when the opportunity arose, I was able to be appointed by the chief judge in 2014. In the juvenile court. I actually, this is an opportunity when I learned that you cannot let fear paralyze you, mm-hmm. because it actually happened. It was at a Christmas bar party, and I saw the chief judge, and I had been meaning to speak to him about my aspirations and goals to, you know, become a juvenile court judge, and how I appreciated his role and his passion for juvenile court and looked up to him. And I saw him leaving the party, and I was having this internal tug of war with, do I talk to him? Because this is supposed to be fun, but when am I going to have another opportunity? So should I go? And I literally like ran after him, caught up with him, was out of breath. And I kind of told him what I wanted to do and my desires. And he said, you know, you are the first person that has come to me and told me their career aspirations. Wow. And because of that, this is how I'm going to help you.
Wow.
And so, and I was just in awe, and you know, it was ever since then I've been able to sit judge pro temp, but I'm just happy that I fought past the fear, mm-hmm. and got outside of myself, because had I not, I might not be able to say that I've been able to sit there. And that was 5 years ago.
But we'll talk about what has happened since when my conversation with the Golden Girls continues. They are lawyers who graduated and now judges from North Carolina's University, North Carolina Central School of Law. They've become judges. Shamika Reinhart, a district court judge in Durham. Camille Banks-Prince, district court judge in Forsyth County. Teresa Raquel Robinson Freeman, district court judge in Northeast North Carolina. And Keisha Wright Hill, a juvenile court judge pro tempore in Clayton County, Georgia. Our conversation continues on the state of things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Our Meet Celebrities are a friendship group, a group that called themselves the Golden Girls when they went to North Carolina Central University School of Law back in 1998. I'm with Shamika Reinhart, who is a district judge in Durham County. Camille Banks-Prince is a district judge in Forsyth County. Teresa Raquel Robinson Freeman is a district court judge in Eastern North Carolina. And Keisha Wright Hill, juvenile court judge pro tem in Clayton County, Georgia, all with me. Let's talk about this Golden Girls. We said that you called yourselves the Golden Girls, but how'd that whole thing come about?
Okay, so I started that.
That's Camille.
Let's go back to that childhood when I first noticed the Golden Girls on TV. I liked the concept of those women living together. My mom wouldn't let me watch the show for obvious reasons. Now, weren't so obvious to me at 10 years old, but I digress. So at any rate, the reruns were on in 1998. Okay. And I said, oh, wow, there's the Golden Girls. And so with the four of us living in the dorm together, it just kind of reminded me of it. So I talked to him about it. And that's where you heard about this game show, or this game that was online at the time, where you could answer a series of questions, maybe 25, and out would pop the face of the one that was your inner Golden Girl. And so that's how each one of these ladies, when they took the test, it popped out just as I predicted.
And I was rebellious.
Yes.
I took the test last.
Yes, she didn't want to accept the fact that she was Rose. She still is
Shamika,
Rose.
Your point is Shamika. Okay.
She was Rose.
Yes.
But that's how it got started.
She's amazing, because you all could have been the same Golden Girl, but you weren't. You were actually all four Golden. You were different characters,
yes.
And you knew who was who.
Yes, already. I did. Easily. I could easily discern which one was which. So.
And in fact, we talked about the fact that, Keisha, when you lost your father, you had to leave school, and this was a difficult time for you. The idea that your character also played a role in this, Camille. I mean, to some extent, there was a correspondence there.
Hers right? did. Dorothy left the show and it became the Golden Palace, and then it didn't do anything. Golden Girls ran 7 years, and when they switched over to Golden Palace, when Dorothy left, the show went off the air. So, fortunately for us, our Golden Girls
yes.
is forever.
Yes. Yes.
We don't want to turn this into the Golden Palace. You've got to
exactly.
go back and get the VCR. It was all... Well, talk about the importance of this now, because, you know, this is a tidy little frame, having the four of you here. The fact that you branded yourselves the Golden Girls, and now you're all serving as judges, three in North Carolina, one in Georgia. But let's talk seriously about the significance of that. Does it matter that that there are black female judges now in the state of North Carolina and in Georgia? Shamika, let me start with you.
Certainly. I mean, I think it's power in seeing a black female judge who is also part of the community in which she serves. She brings a certain understanding and perspective to issues that is certainly needed on the bench. You have two. You have the fact that we are female, the feminine perspective, along mm-hmm. with the race perspective, with the fact that we are women of color. And so it is needed.
If you agree with that, Camille, what does that mean to bring a feminine perspective or an African-American perspective to a place like the bench, which, you know, we consider this blind justice? How do those things work together?
Well, I think the people coming before us, there needs to be things about us all that are relatable. We're making decisions that impact lives. And so a story that I think is relevant to this question, I was at a event on Friday, and one of the lawyers approached me, and she said, I was in court the other day with one of my clients, and her daughter was awestruck when she looked up and saw you as a little black child. And she was like, she's a judge. And she started asking all these questions. And she said, can I be a judge? And the lawyer spoke to her and said, of course you can be a judge. So for me, someone who had no political background, no lawyers, that little girl is who I was at one point. And that's the importance of it. People being able to see our leaders are going to be reflective of what our community looks
and
like.
And Keisha, you had a similar story that you talked about with someone poking their head in the courtroom, right?
Yes, I was on the bench, and when I sit in juvenile court, and there was a little boy. He was kind of scared to come in, but he stuck his head in, and he just seemed awestruck, and he was like, wow, she is black, because he had never seen, you know, a black judge. That's not necessarily what has been portrayed, you know, in the media. Things have changed now and are changing. But when you see someone in a position, it makes you feel like, wow, maybe I can do that. I have the ability to do and become what they have become. I have an example.
And Teresa, we talked earlier about what it means to pay your dues, which means to be, you know, filtered through a particular system. And to some extent, that system will continually replicate itself and continue to look like itself if somebody doesn't break the mold. And talk about the way you approach the bench, because I know you're working now in Eastern North Carolina to look at some of the problems that you see every day and find different solutions. Talk about some of the programs.
Absolutely. So it's definitely about race and gender, but it's also about diversity of thought process and backgrounds. Even among the four of us here, we have different thought processes and backgrounds. You know, the fact that we're four black female judges does not mean we agree on everything, which is good.
Right.
We have had some very
intense,
yes, discussions, I'll say, on different issues even to this day. But that's what you need. We need that on the bench because we have people from all different walks of life who come before us who may commit the same crime, but may commit it for different reasons.
Right.
I'm from northeastern North Carolina, and so poverty is real.
Mm-hmm.
And so a person who commits a larceny from my area, yes, it carries the same time, it's the same crime.
Mm-hmm.
However, the reasoning behind why this person committed a larceny is very different from someone who may have committed that same offense.
Yeah.
In a metropolitan area.
You're doing something about that. You're working with social service agencies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll just tell you, for example, I'm very proud of my child support courts. First of all, no judge wants to be in child support court. Let's start there. And so they always throw the baby judge in child support court.
Well, let's stop there, please. Why not?
Well, most people think, the public and lawyers included, that it's baby daddy court, and it's about collection of funds.
Mm-hmm.
That is part of it. However, there is a whole body of law, believe it or not, that comes along with our child support courts in the state of North Carolina. I understand from a lot of our professors that we lean on that not every judge relies on them or follows them. But I really have from the beginning, 10 years ago, really focused in and honed in on that court and the laws that come along with it. And in doing so, I have found that we need to be an agent for social change in that court, others as well. But this is just the helm that I have taken in my area.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is we're working with ENC Works, which is the state unemployment office. And beginning in January, we're going to work with our North Carolina Legal Aid Services to come in and address mostly fathers who are in that court to see what are the barriers that are preventing them from being fathers to their children.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, it's lack of employment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where NC Works comes in. or the fact that they have a criminal record. And so that's where legal aid comes in and being able to expunge records for free. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that new project that we're undertaking, because don't we all want the litigants in that courtroom to become fathers to their children by paying child support and doing whatever else they need to do that is defined as fathering or mothering, who depends on who the litigant is? And so I don't just see myself as a person that's taking the bench and ruling on the law. I have to do that, yes. Mm-hmm. But when I see that there are social issues that I can address legally without crossing my legal boundaries, I am going to do that.
You have that, and I would say, you know, if you think about it, I mean, if your only remedies are fines or prison time for somebody who's got a criminal record and can't get a job, you're not.
That's
gonna,
all you have.
Certainly aren't going to get child support.
And so I still have children who are not getting child support if the father is locked up. So that's not the answer.
Do you have that kind of latitude in juvenile court?
I like the fact that we do. It's the goal is not necessarily, because we're dealing with dependency and delinquent cases. And so it's not necessarily lock them up, throw away the key. It's to hone in and see what can we do so that you do not return back to our courtroom. So I look at it as an opportunity to kind of be a mama bear. I come in hard initially to let them know that, look, I don't want you to come back here. When you turn 17, you're going to be treated as an adult. But, you know, what do you want to do when you get out of school? How are you going to be able to take care of yourself? What are your goals and hobbies? Because a lot of times it's a matter of finding what the interest is and just honing in on it. And then also giving opportunities for the children to have something to do. A lot of times it's not that the children are bad. A lot of them are followers. And so teaching them to think for yourself. And then also to think about decision making and that there are consequences to your actions. And let us think about what may happen if we take this certain action. So, yes, it's not necessarily, you know, lock them up and throw them in juvie. It's a matter of ensuring that they understand why they are before us and trying to make sure that they don't return.
It's interesting because you're in such an interesting position. You can see this. You can start to put the pieces together and make those kind of decisions. But without the social support around them, I mean, anybody can sort of make a confession and a profession in front of you in that court. But when they get back out in the street, they're facing the same pressures. And if there isn't the support to back that up and reinforce all those things that they've promised you, right? I mean, I would think that could be frustrating.
True, and I think that's why it's important to partner with various organizations, the Boys and Girls Club, mentoring programs, because everyone doesn't have a big sister or a big brother. Sometimes you have children coming from one-parent families that are in the parents working one, two jobs, and they just don't have the time or the opportunity to do what's necessary for the children. So that's where the community needs to help and step in so that we can build a better community by taking care of our future, which is our children.
Camille, tell me how you approach this from the bench. Again, this is a profession. It's the legal profession. You're a judge. And then you see these other issues that are very clearly perhaps outside the law. How do you approach that?
Well, each court is different, and each case is different. Each litigant is different. Each situation is different. So I'm going to use every resource available to me, just as Teresa said, without crossing the line. And interestingly enough, my undergraduate major was social work. And I never knew what I would do with that degree, but I do quite a bit of social work on the bench. I happen to run one of our, what we call in Forsyth County, boutique courts, which is a mental health treatment court. It's one of a handful in this state and nationwide. And that particular court, we have persons who are charged with criminal offenses, but we really believe the reasoning behind, as she stated earlier, their offenses is their mental illness. And so what we do in there is we have a treatment team, and the team consists of the Mental Health Association, someone from the DA's office, someone from the Public Defender's office. Everybody has a common interest in this person getting mentally well and becoming a productive citizen. So what we do is we work hard and tirelessly in that court. If the person is struggling for housing, we got somebody to set them up for housing. If they need a treatment provider, we set that up. We hold them accountable that they're taking medication, that they're going to treatment. And one case in particular in there, we had a 17-year-old come in. He may have been 18. He was a second-year senior in high school. He was set to fail the 12th grade for a second time. So what I did with my team, I was the mama in this case, the judge and the mama. And I said, sir, you are going to school. You're going to get your degree. So between me calling that school, getting his grades from Power School, getting his assignments and threatening, sir, I'm going to have to incarcerate you if you don't do your assignment. I'm going to make you do your project in jail. Long story short, this young man, not only did he graduate from the mental health treatment court and his charges were dismissed, but he also graduated from high school that year, and the team went there to celebrate with him. So that is, of all things that I've ever accomplished on the bench, it was that.
Awesome. Well, Shamika, let me ask you, in Durham County, the same question. How do you approach this job?
Well, I approach it because I look through, I look to every person who is charged or every person who appears in front of me as a story and not a statistic. And I think that's important because how did you get here? And I think that the good judges are the judges that follow the law, get the evidence. I think the better judges are asking those questions so that we can be a part of crafting the resolution that will address the systemic issue and reason as to why they're coming in front of you in the first place. And most of the time, I agree with Teresa, it's poverty. Mm-hmm. It's poverty, and throughout poverty, you see individuals who have mental health issues and also substance abuse issues where they have a dual diagnosis. They may appear in front of you because of immaturity, with respect to their, 13 and 14, 15, 16 and 17. And so Durham is very unique. Mm-hmm. We are always working on social justice issues to try to get to the root of why individuals are even coming to court system. Mm-hmm. We have a great program that was started by Representative Morey, which is the misdemeanor diversion program, which was the first in the state of North Carolina, where we are diverting 16 and 17-year-olds because we have not raised the age of juvenile jurisdiction. I'm currently the judge in that particular program. That's one thing in which we are diverting. And we've also expanded it to 18 and 21-year-olds with respect to simple possession of marijuana. Yeah. Also, we have a mental health court as well. I'm actually going to do that court tomorrow.
You're going to be great at it.
Wherein we truly understand that, the reason why someone is in front of us is because there is usually oftentimes a dual diagnosis where there is a mental health diagnosis, a lack of, poverty because they can't afford the medication. Mm-hmm. You also see a dual diagnosis with respect to them self-medicating a condition. And so we also have wraparound services where we get housing, where we get treatment. I mean, also, Durham is doing a new program. It's called the DEAR program, wherein it's driver restoration because we have individuals who in North Carolina who have a plethora of driving offenses. They're impoverished because maybe they get SSI for whatever reason, and they can't pay the court costs and the fines.
And the fines keep
racking
up.
And that becomes a barrier with respect to them transportation, with respect to them being able to get jobs and all of that. So you have a whole bunch of collateral consequences. So Durham is doing that along with the program?
Restorative Justice Program,
once again, Durham was the first case to do restorative justice where we have various citizens, participating in that program to try to get to the reason of the hurt from both sides, from the person who's charged, who's done the hurt, the person on the other end who's receiving the hurt. So Durham is just very unique. And so when I sit and I preside, I look out and I try to make sure that I tailor my judgment to help that individual and not further perpetuate any harm.
Absolutely.
And you still all stay in pretty close touch.
Yes.
I want to thank you all for being on the program. Shamika Reinhart, District Court Judge in Durham. Camille Banks Prince is a District Court Judge in Forsyth County. Teresa Raquel Robinson Freeman, District Court Judge in Northeast North Carolina. And Keisha Wright Hill, Juvenile Court Judge in Clayton County, Georgia. Thank you all so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.